The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. Falsehood flies and the truth comes limping after it. So wrote Jonathan Swift, the Anglo-Irish writer and satirist in 1710. That was in the 18th century, of course. Now in the 21st century, with the advent of the internet and distribution platforms and new technologies such as bots and deep fakes, the truth cannot even begin to keep up. Our ability to distinguish truth from fiction is a decisive challenge of our age. So what are the consequences? Well, for one, a distorted view of reality makes it much harder to address critical problems facing our society. But there's also a greater long-term danger: radicalization. Radicalization is linked to violence, but not everyone who is violent is necessarily radicalized, and not everyone who is radicalized will resort to violence. Radicalization is a process of developing extremist beliefs and profound convictions that oppose the fundamental values of society and advocate for the supremacy of a particular group, be it racial, religious, political, economic, or social. Once radicalized, individuals or groups resort to either nonviolent coercion or outright violence to achieve their aim and/or defend against perceived threats. If radicalization is a destination, then disinformation is a vehicle. And disinformation is pervasive and far more likely to spread than the truth. According to a 2019 study published in Science by the MIT Media Lab, falsehoods are 70% more likely to be retweeted on Twitter than the truth and reach their first 1,500 people 6 times faster. This effect is even more pronounced with political news than other categories. Since bots spread truth and false information at the same rates, the higher velocity is attributed to human users who click retweet on false information. There is one potential reason as to why: the novelty hypothesis, which found that people are drawn to information that is novel and unusual, as false news often is. Disinformation enjoys advantages that the truth does not. So how do you fight disinformation? In other words, can you use the tools and tactics used by disinformation campaigns against them? Can you provide an alternative view, this time a fact-based one, in such a way as to not only educate people, but also dissuade them from going down the rabbit hole of falsehoods and conspiracy theories? And if so, how effective can you be?
Our guest today is Deborah Lavoie. Deb is a technologist turned marketing strategist who sees disinformation campaigns as a malicious application of narrative and digital marketing tools. As disinformation and radicalization took center stage in 2020, Deb vowed not just to observe, but to fight back. She founded Reality Team, spun up as a nonprofit, with the goal of keeping more people grounded in reality. Reality Team is a project of Hacks and Hackers, a 501c3 dedicated to supporting journalism, knowledge, and ideas, and is supported by a grant from the Craig Newmark Philanthropies. The organization is powered by a team of communications professionals, technologists, cybersecurity and disinformation analysts from the private and public sector who are committed to pushing back against disinformation. The content is entirely independent and nonpartisan, focused on dispelling myths, rumors, and disinformation. In a nutshell, Deb's idea is to change the ratio of good to garbage on people's social media feeds and make it easier to tell the difference. You can find out more at realityteam.org.
Hi, Alexa. Hi, Leslie. Thank you for having me on the show and for that very thoughtful introduction to the subject. I really appreciate that.
So you founded Reality Team on the concept that you can change the ratio of disinformation to credible information and make it easy for people to access it and consume it. So let's take an example, the COVID-19 vaccine. There was and still is a lot of disinformation on vaccines in general, and the COVID-19 vaccine in particular, engineered to spread mistrust. In the COVID-19 vaccine case, some of the rumors are that it cannot be safe because it was developed so quickly, or that it contains fetal cells or toxic ingredients. So walk us through how Reality Team would engage people who might otherwise believe these rumors.
disinformation is successful for a lot of different reasons. In part, it is successful because, as you say, it is salacious. People like to click on it. It shocks them. It evokes an emotional response. But one of the other reasons it's so very successful is because it is extremely simple and extremely repetitive. Anyone who knows much about propaganda or marketing knows that repetition is truth. In the simplest of all possible views of the problem, one of the reasons people are vulnerable to disinformation and misinformation about vaccines, say, is because they hear those lies or those misperceptions all the time and from multiple different places, and they may not hear the counter narratives to those. I like to refer to my kids when I talk about this. My kids are well-educated, they're bright, they spend a lot of time on social media, and they're passive information consumers, which is to say, they're not gonna go to the CDC website or a major newspaper or Johns Hopkins and research the issue. They're just not. What they know about the vaccine is what's coming through their social media news feeds. And that a lot of that stuff is coming from very unreliable sources, some of them intentionally malicious, and some of them just their peers or their celebrities or whatever who have concerns about this stuff and they're spreading misinformation. So step one is to look at what are people seeing in those news feeds and how do you reach people who are not going to go to the CDC, who are not going to be in the networks of public good organizations, NGOs, and nonprofits that share meaningful public health information. And that's kind of where Reality Team started. Without overcomplicating the issue, what is the simplest possible thing we can do to help? And what we came to is the simplest possible thing we can do is to understand the disinformation, create counter narratives, and push it at the people who wouldn't otherwise see them.
I guess a follow-on question is, in particular, the story around vaccines and the COVID-19 vaccine in particular is not always that simple, right? So, and I mean, it's like even mask wearing is not all that simple because it's not about you. It's about, you know, it's about others. So I guess that part of your process has to be in creating that narrative to focus on what are the individual components of reality that are most important to get across. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. And it's a question that we have spent quite some time working to figure out. And we have a couple of different ways of slicing that problem. One of the easier ways to do this is to simply look at some of the disinformation tracking sites and follow along with what is the most popular or most shared disinformation of the day. We're not subject matter experts ourselves. We're not fact checkers ourselves. We're not journalists. What we do is we go find the best available journalism and we talk to subject matter experts. So we have a panel of public health professionals to help us with the COVID vaccine issues and the pandemic issues, doctors and public health professionals, epidemiologists, virologists, those sorts of things. We collect the information, we see the disinformation, we collect what's obvious and available from high quality journalism. We work to translate that journalism into something that's sort of more social media native. So something that is very, 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 very simple. We make it visual in nature. We add a little bit of extra information in text below that, and we always add links to our primary sources. And then in the case of these more complex issues that have subtleties to them, we confer with the subject matter experts to make sure that we are in the process of simplification, not missing the point.
Right. And you've described yourself as a digital marketer, and you just listed a number of things that you aren't, as yes. You self-described. But how would you say your experience as a digital marketer actually prepared you for launching the Reality Team?
So I'll answer this, and I also want to go to part B of the other question. So
sure.
Back in late 2015, early 2016, I saw the rise of disinformation on social media. At that time, it was largely driven by foreign adversaries rather than domestic. That has changed over the years. It is now largely, vastly much more a domestic problem than a foreign problem. But as I saw this come together, I looked at it, and as a digital marketer, I said, this is a digital marketing problem. Whereas all the other people I knew who were looking at it were looking at it. They were either cybersecurity people, they were technologists, they were national security people who were concerned about this. And because I was a marketer, I saw the patterns of what was happening in a very different way than the very smart, very capable people who are working on it in other ways. So I think what's unique about what we're doing is that while we have great respect and largely depend on the network analysis and the cybersecurity elements and the national security elements that are part of understanding disinformation, we see it and respond to it as a propaganda and marketing problem. And that allows us to do things others don't, in particular, messaging. I note that you interviewed a good friend of mine, SJ, and SJ has a great depth of expertise in this realm. She's very insightful. She's done tons of research. She's worked on this for years, but in no way, shape, or form can she engage with people or her the you know large team that she has put together. They are just not prepared to engage in frontline communications with people who are vulnerable to disinformation. They are capable of tracking sources and working with law enforcement to enact interventions and that sort of thing, which I cannot do. So the reason marketing is important here is because understanding how to talk to people, understanding how to make very complicated, nuanced information simple enough to share, understanding the dynamics of digital advertising, social media amplification, that sort of thing is very, very helpful. There's another thing that it helps. I told you the first way we approached some of this information was by tracking sort of the statistics of what was circulating in social media this week. But particularly in the realm of vaccines, there is a problem of disinformation, but the reason the disinformation is so potent is because people have a lot of real concerns. People are frightened, people are worried, people are confused, and it is wrong to think that the reason people fall for information is because they are stupid or uninformed or ignorant or crazy. It's very important to understand that everyone is vulnerable to some kind of disinformation. And people with real concerns and real worries are more vulnerable to disinformation. And a very important component to this, especially in the realm of vaccine and pandemic information, is to listen to those concerns, understand where they're coming from, and respect them, right? People do not get fooled because they're stupid. People get fooled because everyone gets fooled. Disinformation is sophisticated. It understands how the sort of emotional and intellectual tricks that we use, they understand cognition, perception, emotions, and they prey on those things. It's the same tricks that have worked for hundreds of years.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks can probably commiserate with, you know, sitting across the dining room table or the Thanksgiving table with a family or relative who believes really strange things. And even with the January 6th riot at the Capitol, they were interviewing folks, and some of the folks had family members who basically said, look, I beg this person not to go. So there was definitely rifts within family members, very close people who presumably grew up in the same environment, were exposed to the same information. But I think there's an element of psychology here as well, because I read this interesting article just recently on Psychology Today. Why do so many people believe such weird things was the title of the article by Dr. Ralph Lewis. And in it, he said that there are certain people who psychologically are vulnerable. And I think this potentially plays with your expertise in digital marketing, because you've got to target some of these people. Not everybody's going to believe these things. Mm-hmm. So how do you find your target market? And from a psychological perspective, you know, he was identifying a couple of things that I guess his information campaigns can tap into. One was the mistrust of authorities. The other one was a misplaced skepticism. So people who, for example, don't like vaccines are skeptical of vaccines, but it's somewhat misplaced because instead of looking at science, right, over the evidence. Another one was what you just mentioned, cognitive biases, you know, confirmation bias, hindsight bias. How much does this psychology play into how you use it to kind of figure out who the target is that you can be successful with? Because I assume there are some people who may never believe otherwise. Is right. that right?
Yeah. So there's a lot of parts to the question that you just asked. The first thing is to understand that different categories of disinformation can have different dynamics. The second is to understand that the first level of segmentation that we do on the audience, for the vast majority of what we're doing, is to say, okay, look, there are people over here who are deeply grounded in reality and they're fine. There are people over there who are deeply indoctrinated into, let's just call them various types of mythologies that are
already down the rabbit hole. Way too
gone, right?
Yeah.
I do not yet know how to engage that or help that in any way, shape, or form. And one thing we do know is that debunking and counter narratives there can actually be counterproductive.
Interesting.
So the first cut we do is to look at, okay, who's confused and who's vulnerable? When we first started running ad campaigns in order to take our counter narratives and push them into feeds of people who would not otherwise see them, we targeted people who did not read mainstream newspapers. They weren't subscribers to The Atlantic or The New Yorker or anything of that nature.
So they were getting their information from social media.
People who were primarily looking at social media. We also filtered out people who were looking at, you know, Fox or Breitbart or that sort of thing, because again, we didn't feel that was going to be a productive conversation.
Right, right.
So our first whack at it, there were a few other dimensions we messed around with, but basically people who primarily use social media as their primary source of information. And the theory was all we need to do is slip in there. And at the very least, if we're occupying space in their newsfeed, somebody else isn't.
Right, right. Getting into that attention void is what you're saying.
Exactly. In a situation where you have a newsfeed that is likely to have some proportion of disinformation on it, if you can just get on that feed, you are changing the ratio of good to garbage that person is being exposed to. So we are getting in, trying to put ourselves into information deserts. And what we found was, first of all, you know how if you do a business plan, you put together what you hope are not too optimistic figures for what you're going to achieve with your little dollars. Our stats were spectacular.
You mean like in terms of return on investment or what you were doing?
So if you do any kind of digital marketing campaigns, you do any kind of ad buys, the types of statistics you're looking for are, what is your, they call it a CPM. It's the price you pay for getting in front of 1,000 people. You have a cost per click. Mm-hmm. So how much do you pay every time someone clicks on your ad or engages with it or shares it, that sort of thing? Those are called engagement metrics. Then you also have what percentage of people engage with your material, etc. I've been in digital marketing for a long time. I have never achieved stats like this before. And one of the interesting things about Facebook and actually most other ad systems, they're auctions, right? So whether you're advertising on Google or whether you're advertising on Facebook, Instagram, all these things, you're putting in a bid for how much you're willing to pay for a certain ad, for a certain audience, et cetera. When your ad gets a lot of activity, when people engage with it at very high rates, your price goes down. You pay less. And this is part of why disinformation is very cheap to spread through advertising. Now, certainly advertising isn't their only tool, but the cool thing about advertising is you learn a lot, right? First of all, you can very quickly see who responds to your message, what messages work best for what kind of people. So the long and the short of what I was trying to say is that we had remarkably good engagement rates, even amongst not terribly specifically targeted people. There was a lot of appetite for this material. And it was very cost effective to get it to people who would care about it. And importantly, there was a tremendous amount of engagement with the material in demographics that did not typically engage with that kind of material. So during the election cycles in September, October, and then again in Georgia in December and January, we were primarily looking at disinformation around the election, right? Makes sense. Typically, younger, especially younger women, 18 to 35, do not engage with this kind of content on social media. And we had 75% or more of our activity come from women 18 to 35. So we know we can get to these people in ways that are interesting to them.
So are you saying that that age group doesn't engage, of women doesn't engage with the whole topic space on social media, or you're saying they don't engage with the good information particularly?
They tend not to engage with political information in particular. Right. And why that is it because it's too dry? Is it because it's whatever, just not their area of interest? I don't know the specifics behind that. I don't have a lot of data on that. But it is known that it is difficult to target them with political right. information.
So the other thing that struck me about what you were describing was effectively you got in there into their feeds basically by saying, instead of asking people to go to a credible source, you brought the credible information and plopped it right in front of them in their feed. But that seems highly simplistic. So I'm wondering what else you did about the credible information, made it bite-sized, framed it in a way that was, I mean, earlier you said not to be pejorative, not to be argumentative, but what's the special sauce?
Okay, so especially early on in our work, we spent a lot of time building what we called reality cards. And we would have rumor on one side and it would be a phrase. And we'd have reality on the other side and it would be a sentence. And that would be a big, big, nice visual. Underneath that, we'd have maybe a paragraph or so of a little more context, a little more information, and a series of references. So we did make it very, very bite-sized. You would think that a card like that, hey, it's only got 100 words total. How hard could it possibly be? Take us about a week to make one of those, because between
the right words,
doing the research, iterating on that message over and over again, showing it to people, getting their response to it, coming back and refining it, making it pretty, it is fairly labor intensive. And we are working with people who do this for a living. And we did learn over time, some of our earlier cards were a little more, we were trying to be funny. We ended up being snarky. Don't be snarky. Because then all you get is the people who agree with you. And that wasn't who we wanted to talk to. The people who already agreed with these cards, they wanted to take it and like build more snarky conversations about it. And frankly, there were enough snarky conversations right. going on that it was not our objective to do that. So it took us a while to sort of find the right tone. And it's always a little bit of a, it's not a science, it's an art. To sort that out, when we put something out there that's particularly successful, we do sort of take note of why was that successful? Was it the topic? Was it the tone, etc.? In one case that was really interesting, we flighted this ad on New Year's Eve, or maybe it was December 30th, I think. In Georgia, as in many parts of the country in the general election, in the Georgia Senate runoffs, there was one of the prevailing themes was this idea that if you voted for a Democrat, you were inviting in radical socialists. Hmm. And we had known about this theme, this narrative for a long time, but it's very hard to dispel because what are you going to do? Start talking about the means of production? And I mean, how do you have that conversation in 100 words, right? So it took us a long time. It took us months to figure it out. But what we figured out was it wasn't really about trying to define socialism and Democrats and how those things were different. It was about understanding what people were afraid of when they heard radical socialist, what that meant to them, and to acknowledge and address that concern. So what we learned was they were afraid of authoritarianism. They were afraid of dictatorship and all of the things that comes along with that. They were afraid of losing their civil liberties, their religious liberties, and their guns. Mm. So we focused on addressing the fears rather than trying to get into some complex political dialectic on whether socialism is good or not, because nobody actually is prepared for that conversation in this country. And as a whole, we don't know enough to have that conversation. And what I mean by that is people aren't familiar with what that terminology actually means. Anyway, so we finally, after months of trying to figure out how to address that, we put together this card on why are you afraid of radical socialists and why this was not radical socialism. We flighted that ad we only had it up for about a week because it took us that long to get it out there. It performed very, very well. And when we went into the database to look at what other advertisers were focused on those keywords and those issues, there were 12 other advertisers running over 200 different ad variants. Ours was the only one that was countering that narrative. Hmm. Ours was the only one that wasn't saying, save us from radical socialists. What's interesting though, is because of the interest in our card, we paid pennies on the dollar to reach people relative to what these other guys were paying. So we were able to demonstrate that, first of all, there is a lot of interest in this stuff. People do want to engage with this if you give it to them if you bring it to them in a way that they can easily consume, doesn't say, oh, you have to read this 10,000 word article in The Atlantic or whatever. And it's very, very cost effective to do it.
Just to kind of summarize, I think what you're saying is, and to use the marketing methodology, you're really trying to get at these people at the top of the funnel before they go down this funnel and they're radicalized. And the way you do that is to provide them with an alternative source in the way that they consume information using those very same tactics. But I wonder, you know, one of the ways that this information was very successful, at least on social media, was the use of memes, because it was so easy and it was so, you know, entertaining. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about snarky, in my head, I was just picturing all these snarky little memes that people just retweeted or sent. Do you use memes? And can you talk a little bit, because you mentioned that in your website, about these dirty tricks, dirty but effective tricks that disinformation campaigns use. And you talk about which one of those do you use as well, but in the service of the good as opposed to the malicious?
Yes. We were trying to find, again, what is the very simplest, most immediate thing we can do to interrupt this issue of disinformation and protect people from falling into the holes. Mm-hmm. The easiest thing to do was to start at, as you say, that very top of the funnel, the demographic we call the confused, or more accurately, the passive information consumers. As we go forward, we hope to learn more about how to engage with people farther down that funnel. And we could talk for a whole hour about the recruitment techniques, et cetera, that people use. It's fascinating, it's terrifying, and we are learning as much as we can, as fast as we can, but we're not really there yet. So the top of this funnel, keep people from getting so confused that they end up going down these rabbit holes. You asked about memes. Yes. So again, at first, the harder we tried to be funny, the snarkier we were, and we knew that that was working against us. So we went back to sort of the safe place of being more neutral, which was okay. It was a compromise, but we still got a lot of engagement. So we were okay with it. We actually hired a comedian.
A comedian?
Yes, we have
Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart.
No, her name's Lauren. We are actually working with people who just basically are funnier than we are. A lot of our core team is kind of nerdy. Our sense of humor is quite dry, which does not convey particularly well over social media. So we are... Now that we have a little bit more lightheartedness on the team and from several of our more recent members, we are sort of experimenting with memes. They're a lot of fun. We're having a good time with them, especially around dirty disinfo tricks. The backbone of disinformation is essentially propaganda. What the bad guys are doing now is that they are using internet technologies to make their propaganda go farther, faster. Right? Mm-hmm. The tools and techniques of propaganda are as old as time. They're not new. That's part of what makes them so potent and so dangerous. There are generations upon generations of techniques that are really good at tricking us by either engaging our emotions or engaging that part of our mind that most of the way we engage with the world is not through deep analysis, but on impressions. And by manipulating emotion and first impressions, it's easy to get people to think something is logical and rational, even when your argument is completely.
The amphibian brain. Yeah, the amphibian brain, right.
So so the amphibian brain, the lizard brain. So
yeah,
this is what most propaganda works on. And a lot of these tricks, there's a lot of great scholarship that sort of digs in and explores and lists, enumerates the different techniques and how they work and this and that. But our audience is never going to read that stuff. Our audience's interests are elsewhere. Again, doesn't mean they're dumb or uneducated. A lot of our audience is extremely smart and extremely well-educated. It's just they're not interested in that sort of thing, and they never will be. So what we're trying to do is take some of that knowledge about propaganda and make it super simple, kind of funny, just make people aware of these are the ways people trick you.
Mm-hmm.
For example, fake experts.
Right.
There are a lot of ways, you know, when people are trying to prove to you that drinking bleach is a good idea, or
somebody who's not a doctor, has never been a virologist, now telling you about how dangerous viruses are because he's seen one case. Right.
Right. So it's either, you know, someone who has no meaningful credential or a credential in a completely unrelated
different
field,
yeah.
Or it could be someone who's getting paid to say these things, or has some other devious motivation. And then there's always the everyone knows or all the experts.
People are saying.
So what we're trying to do is just sort of show people what that looks like in funny ways and in super simple ways. Not because we're trying to teach them all of the different methods, but we're just trying to sort of let them be aware that these are the ways people get tricked. Everyone gets tricked. You've gotten tricked. I've gotten tricked. Everyone gets tricked. And the goal of this is just to not make them into experts on disinformation, but to just let them have those little, know when to trip those red flags, know when they should be concerned or worried, when they should be skeptical. We hear this all the time. I know someone's lying to me, but I don't know who. One of you is lying to me, and I don't know which it is. So we're trying to give people a way to focus their skepticism rather than just saying, forget it. I don't want to hear from any of you anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't get it. It's too complicated, and there's too much stuff. I can't keep it straight. So Dirty Disinfo Tricks is about teaching people about these various ways. Fake experts, opposite stories. We have a whole list of them. They're starting to come out. And we use memes for that because we actually have a funny person working on them. Thank goodness.
I have to ask, clearly in marketing, you're in a company and there's competition to the company. And so they're sort of like, they're the enemy in scare quotes. And you know, there's a certain vibe of you want to do better for your company. I have to ask, is this a slightly different vibe insofar as you have to win not to make your company more money, but you have to win because this is truth over evil. And does that actually shape your thinking in some way?
It shapes all our thinking, yes. So there's actually two parts to that answer. On the one hand, it is the same tools and techniques and the same ways to measure stuff and the same way to improve stuff and iterate and that sort of thing. On the other hand, there is this great humility that you can have when the problem isn't about you, right? Mm. It's not about us. The group that we have together, the team that has come together to form Reality Team, are really phenomenal people. They're incredibly talented. They're incredibly dedicated. The gift of humility does a lot of things for us. Number one, we don't stay stuck very long. We learn very quickly because it doesn't matter. It worked or it didn't work. It's hard or it isn't hard. It doesn't matter. Let's go forward. So having such an important mission really does help get ego out of the way. It lets you be humble. It lets you learn really fast. It lets you hear the criticism, the critiques, the feedback in a way that I think is much harder when you're in a commercial setting. The second thing is we have found so many collaborators and partners and people who want to help us, because it's an all hands on deck issue. Everyone cares. Everyone wants to be part of the solution. Everyone wants to help. So not only does it give our team this sort of real gift of humility, it has given the whole ecosystem that gift of humility that just makes it so much easier to collaborate, to try wild ideas. We don't know what's going to work. We try stuff and it either works or it doesn't work. And then we try the next stuff, right? We try to do the stuff that worked. We try to do that again. The stuff that didn't work, we try not to do that again. New idea, great, try it. Does it work? We can listen to other people and people who are coming in, people who want to work with us. It really has galvanized a community together in a way and at a level of collaboration that I have not really experienced before across organizations. So that is a real gift. 2020 was a brutal, brutal year for most people. And to us on Reality Team, I mean, we suffered our sufferings like everybody else did, but it was exciting and energizing and meaningful and fun and creative and productive in ways that are very rare and unusual. It was a real gift, and it continues to be.
That's the real value of mission-driven efforts. One of the other differences is I would perceive that in many corporate marketing environments, you are targeting an audience that you could at least perceive as being somewhat like yourself. Whereas in this case, you're looking at an audience, trying to get to an audience that you perceive to have a problem. So how does that impact things?
Yeah. So, you know, when you're marketing, you are trying very much not to make it about yourself. You are trying to make it about them, and you, the more insight, the more you can appreciate and the more you can empathize with what the audience you're seeking to talk to is, the better. In this case, the problem that I am trying to solve for them is that they are overexposed to disinformation and underexposed to more credible information. It's not a personal failing, it's an exposure failure, and it's not really their fault. Bad guys are after them, and we're trying to be the good guys competing against that disinformation narrative. We do not think that those memes, that those super simple, repetitive messages of disinformation should stand unopposed.
More power to you. So it's been a fascinating, fascinating look under the hood, so to speak. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.